Welcome to Escape from Planet A for this week. It's a rare treat because I got a lot of friends on the pod with me today. Recurring guests, I guess, it's the two professors. And we always kind of do this. We got like a book club going on. So, Chong, how are you?
Good. How's it going?
Good. Thanks for making the time. And Fred?
Great to be here.
You're with us too. And this is a real treat. We've got one of the OG Escape from Plan A hosts back from his packed schedule. We were just at one of your readings last night at KGB Bar. It was a real throwback. But do you go by Oxford Condo still?
That name now has a totally different connotation. I guess that people tried to be, oh, you saw this coming? Like, no, that was a total coincidence. But I can't remember the last time I was on. It must have been maybe a year ago, at least.
It was me and you. I remember I forgot what we talked about, but yeah, it was like over a year ago.
Yeah, so it's really, really good to be back. I was just in LA, so I hung out with Jess, and the last time I was there was 2018, which was really when we sort of just started Plan A, and you know, we were fending off our haters left and right. So it was kind of like a big contrast now and then,
yeah,
for the better.
Yeah. Well, today will be a throwback because Chong, you suggested the book for our discussion today, which is the short story collection Rejection, titled Rejection by Tony Tullatamudi. And if this is Asian American lit, it's quite lit. It's very different than a lot of the Asian American writing that I grew up with. And fun read, pretty crazy. I think we'll probably talk about the first three stories or so. But maybe, Chong, how did you hear about this book and why did you think to suggest it?
Yeah, so our last pod, the three of us did, we talked about men without chests. We talked about a little bit about red pill dudes and kind of you know, it insufferable people and people like losers, basically. And, you know, I had heard about the text. I hadn't read Private Citizens, but I heard it was really good. So, yeah, I was looking and I think it's really right up our alley because I think the themes of, you know, being a reject in modern society, men who blame women for their problems primarily. And then also, of course, you know, there's some really interesting female characters in the story too. You know, reading it, I felt a lot of empathy, strangely, for some of the characters, even though they were really unlikable. And I'm almost ashamed to say, like, I saw myself in some of these tropes. Or even just some of the situations, like the dating situations, the feeling of rejection. So yeah, it was really, I think it was a fun read, very witty, very interesting, real page turner. But I think it sort of kind of shows you the ugly truth about yourself that you really don't want to face. So yeah, really liked it. Glad we read it.
Chris, you know this book well because you did read Private Citizens, which is his novel debut, right? And this book followed it up.
Yeah, not only that, but when I first came to New York, I went to the Brooklyn Book Festival, which is something that's it's a big literary event. And for the first month and a half in New York, I lived in Cobble Hill, and they have this thing in kind of like downtown Brooklyn, which is very close to Cobble Hill, and I'd heard of Private Citizens before, you know, because it's like Tony is just like a little bit older than I am. So, you know, we're like in the same age cohort and, you know, it's like a straight Asian male writer around my age who's getting published is, you know, not that common. So I took a big interest in him and there was a panel he was on. I think it was called like Millennial Malaise or something. It was him, Teddy Wayne, who's another really good writer I like, and another writer named Stephanie Dandler, who wrote a novel called Sweet Bitter, which they made into a TV show, which is not good, and her novel's not that good either. But anyway, so I knew who Tony was. I was interested in him. I really love Private Citizens, and he actually teaches and still does. He's pretty well known as a creative writing instructor. He just runs these like independent workshops outside of like MFA programs. So I took one of his classes in like very early 2017. So I wouldn't say I'm friends with him, but you know, we know each other on a face-to-face basis. This past summer, he did a reading in the Upper West Side somewhere. I went to it. So, you know, if I see him, you know, we recognize each other and we say hello and everything and we chit chat. And yeah, so I, as I said, big fan of Private Citizen. So I knew this book was coming out. I was sort of like pessimistic on how well it would do. I'm actually very pleasantly surprised it's become the sort of like cult hit. I don't think you can exactly call it a mainstream breakout, but it's like short story collections. They don't sell unless you're already pretty well known. And he wasn't like a well-known writer. Private Citizens was, it got praise, but you know, nobody really knew of it. And I always felt like I was one of his like few supporters, even though I've got my issues with him here and there, but there aren't that many like him. So I do have like a sort of like a personal history there.
Nice. All right. So that'll make for a good discussion. You probably have pretty strong feelings about this book. So we've short stories. I think there's like six or five stories in here. I figure we'll probably end up talking about the first three.
They're the best. And, like the back end is not as strong.
Yeah. I felt like he was almost just getting a little bit more experimental and just like sort of stretching out just and having fun, but it wasn't as tightly conceived as the first three. But there, I mean, it was a fun read, yeah. At least.
Has anyone else here read Private Citizens?
No, I am not.
Okay, no. So I think it's not a coincidence because the first three stories are very similar to Private Citizens. In fact, some of the characters make appearances. It's kind of like this extended universe. But so Private Citizens, just to give a quick gist of it, is it's, you know, everyone like skewers millennial culture now. It's very passé. If you've read a novel like Perfection by Vincenzo Latronico, he's this Italian writer who wrote this book back in like 2022, but it just got translated into English this year. And now it's become this like hot little book because it makes fun of these, you know, software engineer type or graphic designer, you know, like website designers who have a rootless metropolitan existence, etc. But Tony was doing it back in like the early 2010s. So he's making fun of like kind of like proto-woke San Francisco culture, this mix of tech and wannabe artsiness and this political progressiveness all clashing together with classism and all that. But, you know, if you look at the characters, they're very reminiscent of characters like Craig, who's the protagonist in The Feminist, Allison in Pix, and the third story is Ayagao. And the protagonist of Ayagao is gay, but there's basically a straight version of him in Private Citizens. This Asian guy named Will is a straight guy, but he's also very good at tech, and he has all these like sexual neuroses. So just think of the protagonist in Ayagao, but turn him straight, and that's Will from Private Citizens. So I think that's his wheelhouse, and he's really good at it.
So there's no straight Asian male character in this. We should talk about the first one, The Feminist. Mm-hmm. We'll start with that. But it's about so the first story is a straight white male. The second Pix is a straight white woman. And then the third, Agao, is a gay Asian male. Mm-hmm. And then, yep. So the straight Asian male, I guess, is the subject of Private Citizens. But so for The Feminist,
You mean a straight Asian guy?
Yeah, straight Asian guy.
Well, Private Citizen has four characters. It's you know, they have like kind of equal time, but there's a straight Asian guy, a straight white woman, a straight white guy, and a straight white woman who's like kind of maybe queer, but mostly straight.
Yeah. And so he opens with Feminist. It's a very short story. It's a very short story. And it's there's really not much. I mean, actually, I guess a lot does happen. It's just, it's almost to me just like a carnival of humiliation, and not much happens. We can talk about the ending. I mean, there is an ending to it, but it's basically a montage of just rejection, self-doubt, self-pity, awkwardness, self-delusion, and all this, and written in excruciating detail and in ways that are unique. He's very good at like inducing cringe. And I know that's an overused term, but I found it extremely just cringy and uncomfortable.
Yeah, the cringe, it's over the top, but it's also, you know, an exaggeration of things that everyone's experienced. You know, like trying to appear politically sympathetic. Male feminist is the sort of trope here, of feeling like you've put a lot into a relationship and you aren't getting what you want out of it. In this case, his attraction to all his female friends, basically. So it is cringeworthy, but it's also relatable. And I think in a way, this is going back to something Chung said, I think he's trying to elicit empathetic responses. I don't know if, I mean, at the same time that he's skewering it and satirizing it, it's relatable. So I don't know.
Yeah. One thing the character says a couple of times is acknowledging that his own feelings of rejection and inadequacy are not equivalent to historical oppression and institutional oppression. And that's also something, I forget which other story, but someone also makes that same claim. And it kind of reminded me of David Henry Hwang's play Yellowface. There's a line where David Henry Hwang characters, you know, is talking about lack of representation, Asian representation in theater and film, and says something like, "God, this is like our Rosa Parks moment." And the whole audience starts laughing, and it's supposed to be funny. You're supposed to say, "Well, yeah, obviously, duh. How dare you compare your own problems to institutional problems?" But I do think, yeah, it makes you kind of uncomfortable when even for a moment the reader is made to consider whether there's any validity to, like, why can't a whole generation of people who are having these same problems, you know, these same social and emotional issues due to a lot of reasons, like, no, they're not an oppressed subaltern group, as he says, but the feelings they have are valid. And then taken together with all of the kind of bullshit, like, you know, his little tote bag that says read more women and, you know, the, I don't know, like, I'm the best feminist. I understand why women have their reactions because they're conditioned a certain way. Almost like he's been, like, men have been conditioned to, at least like woke, quote, woke men have been conditioned to sublimate their own feelings as unimportant. So I guess particularly with what happens at the very last scene, I think it is kind of like a roadmap of, like, here's all the feelings and here's how they can go incredibly wrong if we don't acknowledge and kind of do something about it. So I don't know.
Yeah. Just as a little background to the story came out actually in 2019 in N+1, and it caused a big splash then. In fact, we even did a Plan A podcast on it, I remember. And this book came out last year. Mm. So it's interesting how it's a 5-year story. And this is clearly the flagship story of this book. Mm. It is the one that everybody talks about. And if you had to tell someone, like, what's this guy all about? You point to this story. But the story's 5 years old. And it's surprising that nobody has kind of like run with the idea. He still seems to be the only person talking about this. I mean, you would think in the meantime there would be like a bunch of imitators who saw how much notoriety the story had gotten. But you can release it 5 years later and it still seems fresh, for better or for worse.
So what do we take to be the idea here? Because one thing that really struck me is how the main character's explanation of his lack of sexual attractiveness, the narrow-shouldered men thing, finds validation on these Reddit-like internet forums. And that seems to be like the arc of the character. You know, he starts off, you know, doing the women's studies thing, using feminism as a way to try and get women to talk about their problems and relate to them like that. But it's not working out for him. And suddenly he, you know, gets online and finds like-minded people who feel similarly rejected. Like, what do you all take this story to be saying about guys like this? Like,
I mean, I think he goes on to this, or he goes off, right? Like, I forget what happens, but something triggers and he just goes off on this like manifesto on an online forum, which is
what happens is he sees like a younger guy talking about, oh, it gets better, man, you know, just be yourself. Mm-hmm. And he just like, let me tell you, because I think at this point he's almost 40.
You're right. Yeah. Okay.
So he just becomes blackpilled by that point.
He's blackpilled and he sees some young earnest guy and he was like, okay, let me tell you how it really goes. And he goes off on this manifesto. And I think the key, it's a well-written rant, and I've seen rants like this online. And you can just substitute narrow-shouldered for whatever group of guys congregate for whatever reason. And Asian dudes did this online on Asian Reddit. And they would, instead of narrow shoulders, it's just, you know, just the physiognomy of race. Yeah. And he says, but his point here, which this is unique, I didn't really see this as much online on the Asian spaces, but this point that he makes, I get it. I don't really sympathize with this point, but I get what he's saying. He's saying we have been trained to be good men, right? Like allies, we say and did all the right things. And not only did y'all not fuck us and enter relationships with us and then marry us and then have kids with us like we were supposed to, I guess that wasn't that part of the deal, but you went and did it with exactly the kinds of guys that were the quote problem. Right, that's what he's trying to say, and it's like that. I don't think that's an accurate. I mean, this is a story, but I just don't think that's actually what is going on in the world. But I do understand that if you, I can not sympathize, but I can see that if that's how you've organized your observation of reality, that you could get yourself pretty lathered up and say, "Why did I waste my life being, you know, conforming to a standard of being a good feminist male ally, and then I just get, you know, I just get passed over for exactly the kind of guy that I was not supposed to be." So I don't know what I don't know where that comes from, but yeah. That seems to be the basically, to answer your question, Fred, I think that was what I thought his central gripe was.
Yeah, that's definitely his central gripe. I guess my question is more on like what the story is trying to say. Like, is he saying that this is why a lot of young men get involved with feminism because they think it'll help them get laid? Is he saying that, you know, is the story saying that, I don't know, these delusions as to why you're not getting laid get reinforced online? Is he saying, you know, yes, your pain is real, your suffering is real, but you need to like realize it's not about your narrow shoulders or your race or whatever the fuck you think is preventing you from, you know, getting with the girls you want? And you know, and it's hard to tell because this is all satire. The whole thing is like next level, over the top ridiculousness. And it's not, you know, quite clear, like if there's some kind of like political message here, or if there's a moral or that kind of thing.
It's almost sadistic. Like, he's almost creating these characters just to, like, humiliate them and put them through, like, the absolute worst experiences at, like, you know, imaginable for, like you said, for apparently no reason. I don't really discern much of a reason here other than to skewer, I don't think he likes these characters.
Yeah. He didn't really do anything wrong either up until the end, right? He's not like a hateful guy. I mean, he could be really just anybody who grew up in the wrong time period. I feel like he's maybe a little bit later, but I guess since you said it came out in 2019. But yeah, we talked last time about how schools... there was a turning point where schools started to prioritize girls, you know, instead of, you know, boys' education and all these books coming out that came out about, it's unfair that boys are treated the same as girls in school. You know, they get in trouble more. They're more active. Schools prioritize feminine behaviors, blah, blah, blah. So it seems like, he went to a progressive school. He did everything, quote unquote, right. Yet he still ends up, I don't know, just completely miserable, almost like at every turn. And that's why I also do think there's a heavy element of satire, because at every turn, there's just these ridiculous things and his reactions aren't normal. I mean, he's clearly a smart person, but his reaction and his self-analysis at every turn is just so thick and heavy. It's hard to imagine someone thinking this way about, you know, perfectly normal behavior. It's like people looking for problems instead of just, you know, and that's why that final exchange he has, doesn't one of the guys kind of tell him, he reads the guy that says, oh, well, it's not so bad. You know, you have to just get over it, blah, blah, blah. One day it'll get better. And that's kind of when he just says, well, obviously, if someone else is able to get inside my head and describe my situation so perfectly, they must be right about me. And that's kind of the moment where he ends it all, basically, right? Like, he gives up trying. And that, to me, is what's really dark about this story, is that, you know, you think you go on these forums and someone's describing the same thing, instead of, like, sticking around, you know, this is very, even just thinking about it makes my skin crawl, but at least, like, okay, so you're making friends with these guys, you have something in common, there is some hope to, like, maybe you guys can all, I don't know, help each other. But he's like, well, fuck this, they're right about me and I can't change and it's all over. I think that's very dark.
I have a friend, he and I are both fans of Tony, but as I said, we have our, you know, criticisms of him. And one of his criticisms is essentially the most interesting part of the story would be his transition from sort of like an understandably aggrieved guy into a mass murderer. But Tony skips over that part because that's actually the hardest part to write. And by turning him into a mass murderer at the end, you can just dismiss him as like a crackpot, and it's sort of an easy way out. There's one thing that I don't like about the history of the story is right before he published it, he went on Twitter, and I mean, he knew that, especially this is 2019, you know, put yourself in that mindset. He knew the story would get a lot of backlash and stuff. So he put a tweet. He said something like, oh, just for the record, feminism is good. And I don't, what this guy's doing is bad. And it's like, obviously, he kills people. Mm-hmm. You don't need to do that. And then there's another writer. She's like fairly famous. Her name is Carmen Maria Machado. They're like friends. And she came out and said something like, oh, don't worry, guys. He's good. The story's good. I vetted it. I'd be like, no, let us judge for ourselves. We don't, who the fuck are you? You know, you don't need to be the approver in chief or whatever. And then and at the end of rejection, there's that whole sort of like meta rejection letter for that's sort of like preemptively calls out all the stuff that people might criticize him. So he's a smart guy. He knows how this will be perceived and everything. So I don't have the problem with the ending exactly, but without that connection, like Chong, you were saying, it's such an abrupt turn, and he goes from somebody. I'm gonna guess what Tony Fear was. People are gonna think Craig, the protagonist, is actually in the right because his friends suck. I don't know how you guys thought about his friends, but when he's like at the picnic and they're all like, you know, complaining about their dating lives, as soon as he does, they're like, whoa, man, like you don't get to complain. It's like, why does he get to complain? Like, yeah, he's a straight white guy, but he's a real person, you know, and whatever. And I think Tony's perceptive enough to realize there's like bullshit in that. But then if he writes it and people side with the protagonist too much, it's like, oh no, but this guy's like a white incel. You can't feel sorry for him. Mm-hmm. Let's turn him into a mass murderer. How does he turn into a mass murderer is very interesting. But again, it's like, that's hard to write.
So Chris, well, you're suggesting he turned into a mass murderer so the reader is 100% not going to sympathize with him or think he was in the right.
Lends an easy moral to the end of the story.
Got it.
This is the reason I didn't like the first story. And out of the three, I would say it's my least favorite. Is because do we have any, is this an actual thing? Like, are there 40-year-old virgin mass murderers, or are the 40-year-old men mass murdering people actually usually just insane libertarian type people? You know, like who is out there shooting people? I mean, it's like crazy people. It's not, I mean, this guy, I guess you're by definition crazy to do this, but I'm not, you know, when we talk about incel culture and stuff, who, you know, maybe this is like Elliot, like a ghost of Elliot Rodger or something in this. Elliot Rodgers was like pretty young actually when he did this.
Also, he killed more men than women.
He killed more men, and also he was insane. Like, it wasn't that he was an incel. It was that the man was insane, and he
Read his manifesto. He is clearly, something's wrong with him.
Yeah, he's got mental issues. Right. He's not
it
all
had
there.
More, it had a lot more to do with him being completely fucking insane.
Yeah.
Than him being rejected by girls and being a fake feminist and all that stuff. So I just felt like this character, what's his name? Craig? I forgot his name. But
yeah, I mean, it's revealed later in the story itself. He doesn't have a name.
Okay, but this character, I feel like, was just is a literary punching bag, and he's just turning him into this caricature of like a very hated, you know, idea of a man, and the author is saying like, yeah, just to be sure, like this is a shitty guy. I don't know the I'm with Fred on this. I don't really know the purpose of this other than like that this is like Tony's idea of like what a shitty guy is, and it's not a very realistic portrayal in my opinion. To Chong's point, I think a lot of the stuff leading up to that is very realistic. But then this turn to utter irredeemable violence is very strange indeed.
Well, I mean, there is the scene too where he kicks a stroller, and it's meant to be kind of funny, but that part too is pretty dark too. It's just, I don't know, there could be a way to write that scene kind of funny, especially if you think of, I don't know, millennials who bring their babies into bars and everyone's annoyed, that kind of thing, right? A little funny elbow nudge, but he really like kicks, you know, the stroller with a lot of hate, and he's proud of it. So I think there were signs. I wouldn't say that this is a portrait of mental illness in the way that, you know, any kind of mass murdering incel is, because I think at the end he follows one woman. So is he a mass murderer? I mean, I thought it was more that he just sees a victim, and obviously he's planning on hurting a woman. Right. So anyway, yeah, I think that part with the stroller, there's a couple other, lines in the in the story where he describes like this really hot temper, and you kind of see the potential violence simmering. So I just wonder if it's anything more than that. It's just like, there's guys like this. I don't think it's a completely fake character, because I think the way he reacts and the way he feels really sorry for himself in a way that I don't know, to me it evokes a kind of disgust. Like a disgust, because he's just not in control of his emotions. And I feel like, to me, that's what, I don't know, what like a real man is. You know, it has nothing to do with shoulders and gym and nothing to do with how much money you make. It's really just being in control of yourself, right? Controlling your emotions, controlling your reactions. Like, that to me is masculinity. And this guy just ain't it. It has nothing to do with his, you know, his career, what he looks like, how he dresses. And those are the things that these guys focus on so much, is the superficial. And it's not like, get your shit together. You know, it's not that hard, but.
Speaking of shoulders, what do you guys think of that being his main insecurity? Because it's obviously made up. I mean, obviously, broad shoulder is a masculine ideal, but in terms of the whole like looks maxing community, let's say.
I figured it was a MacGuffin.
I've never heard of it. There's mewing, there's, what is it, the cantic tilt, there's hairline, height, obviously. Muscles, essentially, but I've never really heard of broad shoulder or like narrow shoulder, and I think that was on purpose to make it unable universal. To pin that. Okay, let's say he's made it about race. I think that would make the story so explosive that if he made it about race, like if the guy was say like Asian or Indian or like say like kind of a nerdy black guy or whatever, that would make the story too real.
So the shoulders is like deracializing it, because it's not a characteristic of any given race, right?
Doesn't even have to be race. It could be something like height. But then
change your height. You can't change your height, but he does work on his shoulders.
Right, but I mean, shoulders, you have a natural skeleton. So, right. Okay, so he is obviously hinting at these kind of biologically predetermined traits that more and more guys are obsessing over. But he didn't want to focus on something that's too real, because then it becomes too identifiable with like a certain like subculture or whatever. So he made something.
I thought it was basically like, sort of like a kind of MacGuffin that was almost funny. That
insert your own narrow shoulders,
but you know, it didn't really matter what it was, right? It was like whatever these guys want to decide is the limiting factor. And then they can provide ample evidence that women don't like it. Women like height, they don't like short, right? Like, women like money, they don't like poor, you know?
But that was the thing that made the story weak for me, because it had this kind of like plausible deniability. Like, narrow shoulder, I never think about that. Replace it with something, especially for women, that you do think about, like say height or race or whatever. And then suddenly you're implicated. And then by making it something so odd, people can read it with this sort of like, that's not me.
When like this dude's quirk, maybe? Like it's just him?
Yeah, like this guy's just a weirdo. And his weirdo little subreddit of like 500 people or whatever of guys obsessed with their narrow shoulders. It's really funny. Remember how like maybe it was a month ago, AOC made that thing about how Stephen Miller's is short.
Yeah.
And it was really funny for me to watch that, because, I mean, so many guys got pissed off about that.
Yeah.
And it's really just this universalization of things I think Asian guys go through, where we're just like, we have this feature that we cannot change. And on one end, you have this like progressive messaging being like, be body positive, be progressive, you know, be race blind or whatever. But obviously in your personal lives, you see it doesn't matter. And then with this increased obsession with height among white guys, they're kind of getting to see what this is all about. And to see that parallel, I thought was just funny.
I think the narrow shoulder thing is like one step removed from the short thing or the Asian thing or any other, you know, characteristic you're basically born with. And had it been something like race or height or things that guys actually think affects their dating chances, it would have been a little too real.
Exactly.
And a little less fun.
Yeah.
You know, the ridiculousness of the narrow shoulder thing is he's got such an obviously repulsive personality and he's over here attributing it all to his narrow shoulders, right?
Right.
And so we can all laugh at that, you know, because I don't know.
Yeah, the inherent absurdity of a narrow shoulder community.
Exactly.
Online. Yeah.
And exactly. there's that metaphor of like a closed umbrella or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it does allow for that, which is kind of funny, but it's true. As a woman, I have never heard anyone say anything about a man's shoulders.
I will say that Chong, it's interesting that I feel like you're more sympathetic to this character, than I am. I, from the get go, you know, I felt like this guy's problem. And I think he is aware of this, Tony, the writer. I feel like the central problem with this character is he's deluded about his own intentions. And he is deluded about his sort of more base carnal desires. And he just won't admit that that's what he wants. And he demonizes other men who are very straightforward about that. He shames women who... are not either don't understand, like he shames women that either call him out for it or suspect it. He doesn't want to, for some reason, he doesn't want to self-realize that he just wants some ass. You know what I mean? And I got to say that has always annoyed the shit out of me, because guys like him always act like they're better than you. You know?
Well, that's the whole point, cuz if they don't have that, they're not better than you and they're just a narrow-shouldered whatever guy.
Right. So these guys annoy me and because they're not honest, you know, they're just not fucking honest. And to the point that Chong raised about masculinity being in control. It's like, you can't control yourself if you're not even honest about what your goal is. If you're in your 20s and stuff, or you're in your late teens or whatever, I mean, what else is going to be motivating you? You know? And if you never are honest about that, by the time you reach your 30s and, God forbid, your 40s, and you're still under this delusion that you're somehow more, you have better virtues than these, like, other grunty men who are physically superior to you or somehow, like, there's no chance at masculinity in that case. Hmm. So, if there's anything real about his manifesto at the end, that a better, or not a better, but like a more fulsome, like a better self-realized book would say would be the understanding that he just wasn't honest about what he really wanted all along, and it was on him. This was on him, in my opinion. I don't know what y'all think of that, but I knew guys like this. These are the guys that would get fucking friend zoned, and they would orbit some girl who maybe didn't have his best intentions in mind either, but it's not really her responsibility. And he would funnel favors and be a simp and think that he was better than everyone. And then in the end, it was like, dude, you were pressed and you wanted some ass, and then you didn't know how to do it. And you wasted a bunch of fucking time. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what to say about
it. Let me ask this though, Teen, did those kinds of guys consider themselves feminist?
Not in my day.
Like women's studies majors who are men, and they end up married and dating. And so I haven't run into this.
Wait, Fred, are you saying it works?
No, I'm saying the. I don't know a lot of guys.
You're talking about the performative feminist aspect.
Yes.
Oh no, I'm just talking about simps. But yeah, no.
Okay.
I did not see an association between what I'm talking about and performative male allyship or anything like that.
Got it.
But I did pick up on the. I mean, that to me is the sort of like a generation, maybe perhaps a generationally specific thing. Mm-hmm. In my day, you know, I went to college in the 90s. Like, it wasn't a big. That wasn't like a major thing. 90s were not woke, you know, like, so that just wasn't part of the social fabric. But
yeah,
I recognize that in the character. That part rang very true to me was, and I forget where, but there was a part where he openly states, like affirmatively, that his intentions are more pure. But he doesn't get rewarded for it.
Right.
Might have been a part where he's talking with like those two male coworkers, and they're like very typical like fratty bros. They're all just talking about, oh yeah, this weekend I like fucked her or whatever, and then he expresses disgust. There might be multiple instances, but I remember that part.
Yeah, and they tell him to stop being a pussy. They say, don't ask permission to kiss someone. They basically say, you know, grab her by the pussy, basically. But he just can't bring himself. I mean, doesn't he judge them and thinks that they're like unevolved, right? Like, it's this whole idea.
Yeah, he reports
like,
to HR.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Oh, he does that. Oh, right. I don't remember that. Yeah. That's funny.
But I don't even know if he does that because he truly finds what they're saying offensive, or if it's just like he's so, that the idea of being a performative ally is so ingrained. That he thinks that this is what a performative or this is what an ally would do, right? Like, no one's actually being harmed in that situation.
I think he finds them threatening. I think a guy like that will find these dudes. It's almost like he's resentful and threatened because these guys just come out and go directly for the thing that he secretly wants but won't admit. And then they're going to get it, and then he's going to be mad at them. Right. I mean, he's right. Going to always lose the girl to a guy like that, you know, because that guy goes for the thing that he wants to go for. And man, did I know guys like that.
Worst of all, it totally destroys his worldview. I mean, it'd be one thing if they were simply better male feminists than he was, then he'd just be, I just got to try harder. But it contradicts everything he builds himself up to be.
It threatens his ego stability, I guess. Yeah. You know what's a better version? Like, what's a more... in my opinion, like the same story, but a fuller version that has like a good flow and a good ending was The 40-Year-Old Virgin. I don't know if you all ever watched that movie.
Obviously, I've watched that classic, but elaborate. Yeah. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, it's the same thing, right? Like he has these coworkers who are like, you know, you got to find weakness and pounce, and you know, they're giving all this shitty advice, and but I guess in that case, like the character was genuinely just sort of a gentler guy, and
like a lovable guy.
Yeah. Do you think that story was just like 40-Year-Old Virgin was just sort of idealized and it, like that. Like, this is the more, like, real version of 40-Year-Old Virgin. In fact, it's not Steve Carell. It's not a lovable Steve Carell out there who's just, you know...
Mumbling, yeah.
Yeah. Right. But it's actually these sort of, like, internally dark, twisted guys. And I'd rather believe 40-Year-Old Virgin is more realistic, but maybe I'm wrong.
My hunch is the average... like insult, whatever, leans closer to Steve Carell than Craig, because these guys are defined by their ineffectualness. I think the thing that haunts kind of like progressive society is nobody really wants anything to do with these people, but they're not really dangerous. They're just kind of gross. And in their framework, you can't punish people for being gross. They have to actually inflate them into being these dangerous, radicals that are threatening our lives. But it's like, I mean, there's like Elliot Rodger, there's like that guy, Alec Manassian. Technically, he's Canadian, so maybe he's out of like the American jurisdiction. But it's like every now and then, one of these guys pops off. But the vast majority of them are just sort of pathetic. But again, like you can't punch down or whatever. So it, I think people like to imagine they're more dangerous than they are, as opposed to just being sad and annoying. And like Steve Carell is obviously like the, or his character, Andy, is the best example of that guy where, yeah, he's kind of pathetic, but he's a charming in his own way kind of person. But I think the reality is these types of guys are just, they just slip through the cracks in this progressive framework, and nobody knows what to do with them. It's like we can't really include them because nobody wants them, but they're not dangerous enough to really hate. So let's actually build them up into more of a threat than they are.
So I was going to say 40-year-old virgin is basically saying the Steve Carell character is like a fixer-upper. He can actually get the Hollywood ending.
That, but he's actually aspirational. Like if you look at the other characters, like the Seth Rogen character or the black guy, I don't know his name, or the
Paul Rudd
character, they're all miserable. Like they're more sexually successful than he is, but they're all miserable in their way. And like Steve Carell's the one who gets the happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
So the movie's kind of saying, yeah, you know, when he's younger, the Steve Carells might kind of get made fun of, but they're actually better off in the end, which is kind of a fairy tale probably.
Right. So he has the capacity to improve, which is clearly the opposite of what's happened in this pseudo progressive Craig's case. I do wonder about your political point, Chris, because it's right that progressive ideologies like feminism don't tend to think that the Craig type is a victim. And it's in fact his very deep sense of injury and resentment and victimhood that eventually, you know, makes him snap. So I do think the story, I mean, the author seems to skewer especially San Francisco Bay Area progressive ideology or wokeness quite a bit. That story with the main character and the variety of ways that, you know, the university setting, you know, tries to get her to bring out her sob stories and say she's, you know, oppressed as a Southeast Asian woman and all this. So the stance of the author is pretty skeptical towards all progressivism. That would be my thought. And I wonder if there's a bit of critique of feminism in this story for not being able to account for how some males are suffering or some males are, I don't know, in pain or something like that, and is unable to, like, really address it, no matter how much he reads McKinnon and Butler and all these, you know, feminist theorists, they're clearly not helping. So,
but the problem here for him in these feminist social circles is that he's not getting rewarded sexually.
Right. He treats the whole thing
just not
as
the
transactional.
Point of these groups.
It's all transactional for him. Right?
Yeah. So, you know, I agree. I mean, I think it does kind of, well, I don't know. I'm not totally sure it is leveling a real critique at feminism other than to say this guy's barking up the wrong tree. Hmm. I don't know what you think of that, but.
I said this before, but I don't
think. He's in the wrong friend group.
Speaking of friend group,
I don't think the story portrays his friends very flatteringly, which is why I think he, Tony might have felt the need to tack on the ending that really defines him as the bad guy in this story.
Do you think Tony found himself in such a situation? Like, do you think this comes from any level of like personal experience with these groups?
I really don't want to, because, you know, I sort of personally know him, but obviously I don't know it, so I don't want to speculate. But I would not be surprised if a lot of this is based on his experiences as like an older millennial. He went to Stanford. He grew up in, I forgot where he grew up, but, you know, we kind of know what that era was like. I mean, I'm sure he heard a lot of just like doublespeak between, especially what women said they valued versus how they acted. And I think he has admirably carved himself out a space in this literary world where he can write about this kind of stuff and get praised for it by the mainstream. I mean, like, the type of like New Yorker reading crowd really likes this book, and that's quite an achievement. But he also knows how precarious that situation is, because there's nobody really else like him. So I do think he's not just using his imagination here.
From that point of view, like, you know, the character here is, I said, barking up the wrong tree, right? Like, you're trying to get in with this group, but then you want a certain kind of reward for. But in Tony's actual case, he had to, because if you want to be a published writer, that's the kind of culture and that's the kind of social milieu that you've got to go through to get published and noticed and rewarded as a writer. So I don't know if that sublimated onto, you know, the situation that this guy found himself in, and he just sort of like dramatized it. But in that case, I would say, you know, if the reward you're seeking is to get your story published and you're just trying to fit in with the literary crowd and you're finding out that it's like hypocritical and kind of fake and bullshit, then is this story deep down really a satire, a metaphorical satire for his frustrations, not for failing to get laid, but for failing to get published, you know, or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah. So, Teen, at the end of the book, there's this section called Regarding Rejection. And it's, I think it's fictional. Is that right, Chris?
Yeah.
But it's like a 10-page letter.
I think it's like a lampshading tactic to be like, I know what you're all thinking, so I'm just going to get ahead of it. And I mean, one of the things I remember most from it is, like, you know, because the conceit is his agent is telling him, criticizing this book. And one of the things is, oh, I noticed that none of the characters here are characters like you. I mean, there's the protagonist of Al Gao, I forget his name, but he's like a short Thai American guy, which is what Tony is, and who Will in Private Citizens, one of the Asian protagonists, is. So it's not like he's afraid to write that character. Maybe he was just like, well, I've written him before, I don't want to repeat again. But in this imagined criticism, it's like, oh, you make fun of all these people, but you don't make fun of yourself, at least your identity group. So I'm just like, I feel like, again, that's preemptive self-criticism to get ahead of the story.
Yeah, the whole fake letter from the agent is about literary rejection. Sorry, that's why I brought this up. So yes, it's interesting that all the stories, save for main character, are basically about sexual rejection. Am I right there?
Pretty much.
And they deal with not only the male side of it, because, you know, and I think Chris brought this up in his review, that second story is about a woman getting rejected, you know? So there seems to be some kind of, I don't know, intense feeling around this sexual rejection bit. I think that's worthy of, that's a point worthy of raising. And well, nobody's on the other side of it, sorry, Chris.
Nobody's really interested in like getting rejected from your job. I mean, this is what people care about, right? Everywhere you see, you just dig a little bit under the surface, it's all fuckability politics. So, I mean, rejection, what people care about is like dating and sex, you know?
And that's an interesting thing in and of itself. Like, why is this like the thing that your self-worth hinging on. I don't know if this has a sociological or political or what the explanation of that is, but I'm just going to note that. The other side of it, I think, goes back to something Teen was saying. The problem is when you moralize sexuality and are just unable to say what you want. And I think that Kant story is all about that. Like, yeah. Somehow you make this, what actually you find sexually arousing and gratifying into this somehow shameful and guilt-ridden thing, and you can't just say it. And, you know, Kant's with his boyfriend and he's just unable to express himself because the guy's a sadist, you know? And there's a lot of sadomasochism in this book, you know, both in the book, you know, that third story in particular, but also going on with the audience, the author and the reader, because, you know, why are you showing these people at their lowest and their most humiliating and their most pathetic? You know, you wonder if, you know, one, if they're sort of gluttons for punishment, but another thing is, like, it's kind of entertaining, frankly, in maybe not a progressive way, maybe not in a, you know, feminist way, maybe not in, like, moral of the story way, but it's, I blew through the first three stories in, like, a day. Like, it was hard to put down. This was pretty engaging. And at the same time, like, oh, this is so wrong. This is, like, you know, especially that third story, so which was, like, one of the dirtiest things I've ever read in my life. I could not, I mean, I don't know if I'm sheltered or whatever, but, like,
yeah,
that 20-page sexual fantasy when he was filling out the order form on the make your own porn site, I was just like, whoa, this is, yeah. Sorry, so there's definitely something which, going by the way, on we here. Should, like, we should sex is just sex.
We should get a digital version of it, and then just paste that extended description into Sora, yeah. And see what it comes out with.
Yeah.
Oh god.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Okay. So should we incorporate the next story? So we can do this on the bonus side of this pod, and we'll incorporate Pix.
All right.
Yeah. Pix is the second story. Which, for listeners, very interesting story. It's about...
this is my favorite story, just because... I'd already read The Feminist years ago, and it's always interesting to hear about, essentially, like, fem cells.
I like the story a lot, too.
Yeah, and it's very interesting for me as an Asian guy, because it involves a white woman getting rejected by a very desirable white man for a hot young Asian woman, which I thought was really interesting.
Well, it's a question about how desirable he actually is. I mean, he's obviously desirable to her, but it was hard to tell whether he was
actually our West Elm Caleb.
Yeah, he seemed more just like kind of like a dorky guy that the protagonist just got obsessed over.
Yeah, so we'll continue this on the bonus side, and if you want to get access to bonus pods, go to patreon.com/planetmag.